So the very last evening of our Vassa retreat, and I know I've said it before, but just to express my appreciation for everyone, really, but especially our small support team, because it's been such a harmonious time. And you know, for me, boring is good for meditation retreats. You know, the least eventful is possible. There's an old Chinese proverb or adage that goes something like, if you want to curse someone, may you be born in interesting times. It's like as interesting as like bound to produce difficulty and dukkha. So for me, boring is good for practice of retreat. Things chilling out, so you don't have to deal with too many dramas and upsets. We've got enough of the internal stuff going on naturally too. So it's so very fortunate and auspicious to have had this harmonious and relatively quiet time to cultivate. You know, this path is one of ongoing cultivation, and it requires a lot of faith, actually. I mean, I've been practicing for quite a few years, and in looking back, I can see, you know, different stages and different kind of phases one goes through. But I think that also has a lot to do with one's age and maturity, and being now in my 50s, things are a lot easier in terms of, I don't know what it is exactly, but in one's 20s and 30s, whether it's karma or whether it's circumstance, there's just a lot more stuff going on, a lot more stuff arising, and looking back can see how much, also so much of my practice and effort in practice was driven by hope and fear. And maybe subtly so, not obvious, but when you look back, it seems a bit more, well, a bit less subtle, really, by comparison. So the last month that I've had on retreat is, you know, I would say there's nothing, no big earth-shaking insights coming out of it, but a deepening into understanding just the way this mind works, the way it spins, you know, perpetually. It has its quiet times, but when one is not focused or settled, just seeing how we bring the world into existence, or how the mind, it's not even a me or an I anymore, just how the mind, the power of karma, the power of having sense bases, the different mind states, and how it spins the world into existence. And I remember one of the early talks in the retreat, or maybe it was prior to the retreat starting, talking about how the Buddha teaches that the world is really what we experience through the six sense doors in this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception, is the world. He said, the arising of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world. And this mirrors the Four Noble Truths of the arising of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. So this is all within this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception, the creation, the arising of this stuff that where the self, the sense of self, the sense of separate self, the egoic self, the self-tormented self is born in opposition to the objects, the things out there, and the various play of love and hate, or the push-pull, the wanting, not wanting, that happens with the birth of all that, even very subtly. And this is just to be witnessed, just to be known, and as much in its arising and kind of turbid motion, to know its ceasing mode as well, to know how it stills and how it quiets. And in those moments of quietude, when there's nothing much happening, just this awareness, knowing a moment of sense contact arising and ceasing, and maybe nothing much beyond that, to see that this is really pointing to the cessation or the ceasing of that very world that can arise in one's mind, in the mind, when there's a lot more activity and motion going on, and desire and aversion, hope and fear, etc., etc. So to see the cessation is very much it's very important to recognize those moments of cessation, even if it's very momentary, to know when things still, when agitation subsides in the mind, to know what's present, what remains, and what's disappeared. Because this comes very close to the Buddha's pointing to the realization of Nibbana and the cessation, not just merely the cessation, the momentary cessation of sense activity, but the cessation of the activity of hope and fear, of wanting and not wanting, the desire and aversion. To see that settle, even momentarily, is in the territory of Nibbana. Even in these very ordinary moments, we might not think so, because we kind of create this big notion of what Nibbana is, what enlightenment must be, and it must be so far away from me and my experience and everything I've got to battle with and all my problems and blah, 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 blah. But when the mind just steadies and stills and stops, this is an important territory to stay aware of, be present with, to get to know, to understand. And it's very hard actually for the conditioned mind to come into an appreciation of this kind of experience, because you know, in some sense it's terrifying for the egoic mind that's been conditioned to move ahead and to get things and get rid of things and to become something. So when all this activity subsides, there can be a kind of fear or uncertainty or terror emerge that, you know, must keep moving at all costs. Keep a dancing, Maria. Do you remember that television show? keep dancing, Maria. Was it Ugly Dave Gray or something? I can't remember who it was. Or Benny Hill. It just came to mind. I guess you guys don't know it.
I remember Ugly Dave Gray.
Keep a dancing, Maria. Anyway. It's that, you know, that can happen in the mind. It's like, oh, who am I? What's happening? Nothing's happening, you know. And the mind stirs itself up again, or we might experience it as just getting distracted or attention averting here and there, or not to get too disturbed by that in itself, but just to begin to recognize more and more those places of stilling, those places of cessation. They have qualities of spaciousness. And if you start to recognize this quality of spaciousness, what's called the element of space, the space element, And even recognize the consciousness element or the knowing element. These are more fine experiences in the mind, and as we come to recognize them, it can help create a bit of a stability there as well, rather than you know, getting pulled back into the more conceptual proliferation of the mind. We can steady attention on just recognizing space or stillness or settledness. And as I said, this doesn't have to be big moments. It can just be recognizing those little moments of it. And one day, one meditation session, you might find yourself having wandered into a big field of it, but because you know it, you don't get so scared by it, or the mind rather doesn't get so you know, put off by it. We just, and then sometimes those spaces just extend for what can seem indefinite at times. So staying present with that is really, really helpful, and appreciating that the peace in that. This is close to Nibbana. I'm not saying it is Nibbana, but within this, there's an equanimity in the mind, and equanimity is an enlightenment factor. Equanimity can be the springboard to insight. One can never predict insight, that's the thing. You know, if we go looking for insight, you never really find it. But if you learn to settle the mind and keep that openness of awareness, then when the meditation factors are balanced in a certain way, or perhaps it's dependent on karma as well, sometimes insight just emerges, whether it's in the meditation or whether it's after meditation, when one is still moving within with a degree of equanimity and mindfulness. Sometimes just that clarity, one sees things and a new understanding emerges, which is non-conceptual. We might later at some stage be able to put it into words, but real insight is non-conceptual in the moment. So to trust this process of meditation is something again that we do learn, and by saying trust the process of meditation, I'm not implying you can only trust those moments of stillness or spaciousness or calmness or clarity, but as I was saying earlier in the guided meditation, and to bear witness to all the different mind states that we experience is very important. And to bear witness to how we get drawn into those mind states such that we feel it's me, and we, you know, and we start reacting to it, trying to get rid of it or push it away or do something else, but basically, you know, you're kind of in it. So learning how to bear witness to it takes time, because we have this naturally conditioned habitual reactivity to unpleasant things. We want to get away from them. But meditation is all about seeing those antics of the mind as well, and how we get. At times we feel really in it, pulled into it. At times we feel like it's possible just to sit back and be aware. So we can't necessarily control these times, you know, in the learning process. We just do as best we can, you know, remembering the refuge in awareness, in knowing the Dhamma, and in trusting our capacity to see what's happening, and ultimately our capacity to awaken, and trusting in this inherent awareness that has that power to know, to see just what is. Doesn't have to be more than what is, because if we try to see and know more than what is, inevitably it's conceptual. you know, and it just becomes thinking. The Dhamma, the liberating Dhamma, comes out of just seeing the way things are in this moment. And this can be very ordinary or seem very ordinary, but extraordinary things can arise out of that ordinariness. Gradually this process can help expand the mind and grow wisdom. So finding, you know, in any periods of retreat or in any aspect of daily life, knowing what's present, knowing what's affecting the heart and the mind is important, and from there we can engage or develop skillful means, you know, knowing, again, learning what's helpful and what's not helpful. We develop skillful means to support ourselves in the path, to somehow engage certain mind states in ways that just may help the difficulties subside, you know. And for that we just need to explore, to learn what works, because what works one time won't necessarily work another time. So if it works some time, that's great, it's in your toolkit. If you try it again at another time and it doesn't work, it's not a problem, it just means wisdom has to work and tune in and discover something else, discover something new. So, you know, this path of practice is really something we need to own 100% in a way. It sounds strange to own it, but maybe it's like, it's more like not being afraid to take it on fully and experiment, explore, be creative with it and learn from the results. Because if you discover ways that allow the tightness, the clinging to release or insight to arise, then this is the path, you know directly, this is the path. It doesn't mean when we're feeling muddled and lost and confused that we've necessarily lost the path, because it's just a moment to refocus awareness and know, this is the mind state of confusion. This is what confusion feels like. This is what doubt feels like. It's just that shift of view. You're either in it and believe this is me and mine and therefore my problem. And then if you recognize that and establish awareness and know it. Okay, this is me feeling sorry for myself, or me feeling immense grief. Or rather, you can shift it. Take the me out of it and just say, there is grief present right now. This is the experience of grief. It feels like this, the heart's tight. There's a feeling of miserableness, but there's this awareness of that. So sometimes learning how to language it can make the difference between being fully in it and submerged to just shifting slightly, not suppressing or denying what's present, but shifting the emphasis to knowing it as a mind state. And to explore this, to take this into your practice, you'll see the difference as you do it. You know, there's just moments, even if we can manage that moment, a few moments here and there, it will have a certain power to generate that perspective. And the other thing I obviously always notice on retreat is when you have a bit more space open up for practice, to focus more on your meditation practice. Initially I find, you know, reading some Dhamma helpful to orient, and after a while I kind of lose a taste for taking in too many concepts and just like to sit more, be with this mind more and watch it. But then you watch the tendency, you know, as you get into not being so stimulated by concepts, and then they just watch the mind searching for something to latch onto, and it just trails through the past endlessly, you know, rehashing the past, or, you know, jumping into something, even just a little something in the future. You know, at 5 o'clock I'll do this, or there might be larger moments, bigger moments of projecting into the future, becoming. So just starting to get to know the antics of the mind. You know, it does that so much, so hard it is for this conditioned mind just to know the present, just to be still. So we learn what it is to let go through meeting. Ah, there's another memory. Well, there's a choice. You know, you either relive it or reconstruct it. This mind tries to reconstruct the past in terms of the things that didn't go so well. How can I rewrite that history? How could I have done it better? You know. And it's just, that's just a waste of time. But it's interesting to see how the mind tries to do it, all in an attempt to get away from some painful feeling in the present, which is associated with some memory. It's just a painful feeling arising in the present. Mind buys into it in terms of self, you know, goes back into story making. As Ajahn Brahm says, it's not a true accurate account of what actually happened. It's a memory based on the last time you remembered something, based on the last time you remembered something, and it's just all rather filtered, selective kind of memory. And when we're in a kind of a mode where we've got the bad self-image going, we can remember all the bad things. And when you're in a mode where you've got the better self-image going, you remember different aspects of different experience. So again, you can see the filtered glasses of these mind states, how it picks out different things. But the practice is simply to know this is a memory in the moment, and not even accurate one, it's just a perception. To know what it stimulates in terms of desire, aversion, anxiety, whatever. And the practice is to just to let go, not to push away, not to try to get rid of. The practice is exploring what is letting go. So in my experience, letting go happens when I see clearly this is a perception. It's here, it's just arisen in the present, it's a perception. And then it's gone again. If I can see that, it's let go of. Clinging is abandoned. There's no I-making or my-making around it in that moment. It might re-emerge because of the power of karma or self-view, but the practice is just keep seeing, huh? Another perception. And then gone. And just trusting in that, because the more you do that, the more present you become. There is just this moment. You start to recognize being born into a past memory, how one's awareness kind of gets drilled into this very tunnel vision. You've lost awareness. We've just been born into some recreated moment. And similarly, when we're kind of creating the future in our thought construction, it can stimulate all sorts of things in terms of excitement or fear, but actually you start to recognize how awareness of the present moment is lost and we're just caught in proliferating. And we can equally create bad futures and good futures, like we can draw up the bad past or the good past and suffer accordingly or revel accordingly. And all of this is mind-made. All of this is just the world arising and ceasing in this fathom-long body with mind and perception. This world of our own psychological experience. So the more we see that clearly, this is just how the mind has been conditioned, and how this is how suffering emerges in a conditioned way when we don't see these patterns clearly and have the strength of mind to pull out of these patterns and recognize what's going on. And to do that, we need to develop that power of samatha, of, you know, which is like one of the metaphors is like putting a stake in the ground. I think I mentioned this in one talk. The six senses are represented by the six different animals who are tethered together, and they're pulling in different directions, wanting to go to their own feeding grounds or habitats. And the strongest one at any given time pulls a little sway. But samatha, or stilling the mind, the Buddha talks about, is that stake that gets put in the ground, and the animals are tethered to that, so they can't really go very far. It's like mindfulness of body, or stilling, a degree of stillness or stability. So they get restless for a while and act up, and eventually they just settle down and lay down there. And that's in our experience when we feel some clarity and awareness and some settling. For a moment, these different sense doors have settled down. Sense activity rather than sense doors. So just seeing all of this as the play of karma, you know, it's not that I'm doing it in the sense that it's somehow me or my fault. It's not that we're not involved, because there's these habitual tendencies and our attention gets pulled here and there, and then we get excited about this and contribute to that, or get caught up in aversion with this and contribute to that. So it's not that we're not doing it, but it's not that we are really doing it either. It's really the power of karma, craving and ignorance which is keeping the whole show going. And our awareness can begin to recognize that, witness that. And the more you trust in awareness, the more you can learn to step out of it. Step back, step out of it. Come back to here, come back to now. Let that memory fade. Let that idea of the future subside. What's present? What's really present? Breath, the body. You know, maybe some mental feeling of mental activity or waves in the mind. But really it's just this. So coming back to that as a kind of a refuge to start to get perspective on what's going on, and realizing none of it, we're encouraged, the Buddha says, none of this is to be taken as me and mine. As soon as we do, we're involved, we're investing, we're putting in energy, and it keeps the spinning going. If we can practice seeing that this stuff is conditioned, past karma, it's ever changing. It's like it's an unstable show, you know, it's on, and you know, that's the kind of samsaric nature of it. It's kind of just powering itself, really. It becomes like a really boring B-grade movie or C-grade movie. And partly getting bored with it is good. because then you're starting to invest less energy and less attention, and you're not taking it so seriously. That's a bit of an aspect of nibbida in a way. You're kind of getting tired of it and just letting it go its own way. So that's when the letting go is happening a bit more. But to put attention into this quality of presence and awareness and building, developing that is going to serve us well for stability of mind, but also that clarity. The knowing emerges as wisdom, as we begin to understand what all this stuff is made up of and how to keep releasing out of the of being caught into it, being caught into the dukkha of it, and trusting that process really. Sometimes we lose perspective on the whole thing, but then we'll wake up a little bit and recognize and correct. And the thing about, you know, coming back to awareness, we never really lose it, but we lose the perspective, if you like, of that broad awareness. Awareness is always present, and it's vibrant, it's absolutely vibrant, and even if one's body is sick and dying, awareness can be vibrant. And I think coming into a genuine experience of that as much as possible, void of overlays of self in relation to what I was in the past or what I want to become in the future or even what I am now, releasing any of those conceptual notions that may appear, and just trusting in the power of this awareness, which is really this fundamental aspect of our beingness, which in its essence is profoundly mysterious. We don't know that. We don't know what that is. And it's like we search, we create all sorts of things through searching the past and the future in our life, and we miss this profound jewel of awareness itself, which, you know, again, I say is very close to the experience of Nibbana, in that it's, you can't put your finger on what it is. It's vibrant, it's present, but you can't really find what it is. And yet it's undeniably present. It's not confined necessarily to this body. It's a non-local experience. It's the basis, consciousness is the basis of all life. And there's so much we don't know about that. You know, we might think we do. We can quote the texts or quote some kind of science. But in actual experience, spend time with it, with this interest in the mystery of it. Not to try and define it, but let the very experience of it inform you from a deep level. Because this is the birthplace of wisdom, in my experience. And this is the place really that we point to as the refuge in Buddha, that quality of presence or knowing. We use this faculty of the mind to come to fully understand the mind in all its wanderings, in all its manifestations. And eventually mind comes to understand the conditioned and the unconditioned. Samsara and Nibbana. So comes to understand what it's the experience of dukkha and the release from dukkha. So if we recollect, for me anyway, it's always been helpful to recollect the great, in one sense, the great mystery of this present awareness, because it makes my practice alive, pulls it out of any conceptual view, and it, you know, it becomes a creative and empowered journey in that way. The journey back to where we never left. So that's all I'll say tonight.